Among the handful of groups to hoist the nationalist banner, only the Nation of Islam had any significant following. Minister Farrakhan's sharply cadenced sermons generally drew a packed house, and still more listened to his radio broadcasts. But the nation's active membership in Chicago was considerably smaller. Several thousand, perhaps, roughly the size of one of Chicago's biggest black congregations. A base that was rarely, if ever, mobilized around political races or in support of broad-based programs. In fact, the physical presence of the nation in the neighborhoods was nominal, restricted mainly to the clean-cut men in suits and bow ties who stood at the intersections of major thoroughfares selling the nation's newspaper, The Final Call. Questions of competition, decisions forced by a market economy and majoritarian rule, issues of power. It was this unyielding reality that whites were not simply phantoms to be expunged from our dreams, but were an active and varied fact of our everyday lives, that finally explained how nationalism could thrive as an emotion and flounder as a program. So long as nationalism remained a cathartic curse on the white race, it could win the applause of the jobless teenager listening on the radio or the businessman watching late-night TV. But the descent from such unifying fervor to the practical choices blacks confronted every day was steep. Compromises were everywhere. The black accountant asked, "How am I going to open an account at the black-owned bank if it charges me extra for checking and won't even give me a business loan because it says it can't afford the risk?" The black nurse said, "White folks I work with ain't so bad, and even if they were, I can't be quitting my job. Who's going to pay my rent tomorrow or feed my children today?" Rafiq had no ready answers to such questions. He was less interested in changing the rules of power than in the color of those who had it, and therefore enjoyed its spoils. There was never much room at the top of the pyramid. In a contest framed in such terms, the wait for black deliverance would be long indeed. What in the hands of Malcolm X had once seemed a call to arms, a declaration that we would no longer tolerate the intolerable, came to be the very thing Malcolm had sought to root out. One more feeder of fantasy, one more mask for hypocrisy, one more excuse for inaction. Black politicians less gifted than Harold discovered what white politicians had known for a very long time, that race baiting could make up for a host of limitations. Younger leaders, eager to make a name for themselves, upped the ante, peddling conspiracy theories all over town. The Koreans were funding the Klan, Jewish doctors were injecting black babies with the AIDS virus. It was a shortcut to fame, if not always fortune. Like sex or violence on TV, black rage always found a ready market. Nobody I spoke with in the neighborhood seemed to take such talk very seriously. As it was, many had already given up the hope that politics could actually improve their lives, much less make demands on them. To them, a ballot, if cast at all, was simply a ticket to a good show. Blacks had no real power to act on the occasional slips into anti-Semitism or Asian bashing, people would tell me. And anyway, black folks needed a chance to let off a little steam every once in a while. "Man, what do you think those folks say about us behind our backs?" Just talk. Yet what concerned me wasn't just the damage loose talk caused our efforts at coalition building, or the emotional pain it caused others. It was the distance between our talk and our action, the effect it was having on us as individuals and as a people. That gap corrupted both language and thought. It made us forgetful and encouraged fabrication. It eventually eroded our ability to hold either ourselves or each other accountable. The continuing struggle to align word and action, our heartfelt desires with a workable plan, didn't self-esteem finally depend on just this? It was that belief which had led me into organizing, and it was that belief which would lead me to conclude, perhaps for the final time, that notions of purity, of race, or of culture could no more serve as the basis for the typical black American self-esteem than it could for mine. Our sense of wholeness would have to arise from something more fine than the bloodlines we inherited. It would have to come from the messy, contradictory details of our own experience.